Hi, this is Paula Moreau, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Daddy's stories will do just fine when he talks about the Cotton Patch.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Rena Wren? Y'all like Rena? Rena Wren is a singer-songwriter currently residing in Hot Springs, Arkansas. She is a true indie artist with a distinct sound, writing across genres for her own albums and for film and TV. She has CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at renawren.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark has played on the original King Biscuit radio show and Beale Street Caravan, both with blues legend John Weston. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and tonight's featured artist is Arkansas painter Doug Norton, and our featured piece is this piece right over here entitled simply Razorback, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Doug at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, our stories all center around, in various ways, gifts. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Mary Ann Kovach receives a surprise gift, and will end the night with Martha Peters and her mother's gift to one man. But let's start the night with Lisa Brandom as the gifts keep coming in Dancing on My Toes.
I was racing my red tricycle around and around our small apartment in Greenville, Mississippi. It was 1950, and as I raced by my mother, she asked me to come and sit on her lap for a few minutes. I continued doing wheelies until I heard, "Martha Elise, I have something serious I want to talk to you about." I skidded to a stop and climbed up into her soft lap. She told me that she and my father, who was a compulsive gambler, hopeless alcoholic, and serial womanizer, were getting a divorce. Nothing would change in my sister's and my lives except that he would not be around anymore. The divorce was final in a couple of months. I was 6 years old. It didn't take long for me to realize the perks of being the daughter of a beautiful, raven-haired, brown-eyed, single mother. My mother's first boyfriend was a Cherokee crop duster from Oklahoma. I immediately began to imagine myself at some time in the future sitting by his side in the cockpit, flying low over the cotton crops in Mississippi, trying to ensure that those pesky boll weevils would never attack. Mama felt instantly in love. That Hank was in the process of getting divorced from his wife did not seem to be an impediment. They planned to marry until Mama discovered Hank was still in love with his wife, so they reluctantly said goodbye. Since we were poor, Mama had to get her first real job as a waitress at the local motel restaurant. She soon met Harry, who owned a car. Mama never learned to drive, and he took us on Sunday afternoon drives over the new bridge over the Mississippi River to Lake Village, Arkansas. The highlight of the afternoon was to stop at Stuckey's and buy a pecan roll. One day, however, Mama noticed Harry sitting at the table, teaching me how to forge a check. The check was reading $3, but he changed it to read $300. This incident evidently ended a possible but promising future career for me. By the time I was 7, I fell in love with one of those Christmas trends for little girls in the early 1950s. You remember them. It was a white, soft muff made of rabbit fur with matching white earmuffs. You know, the kind that were in White Christmas when Bing Crosby is singing the popular song of all times. I knew Mama could not afford to give those to me, so I really tried to believe that Santa would at least bring me that, or perhaps a cowboy outfit, complete with scabbard, pistol, leather-like vest, skirt, and cowboy hat. It was not until I was 12 and practically moving into adulthood that one of Mama's boyfriends made sure I had the much-longed-for hand muff and earmuff under the tree. There I sat, feeling very foolish on my grandmother's fold-out sofa, wearing my pajamas with my gigantic adolescent hands shoved into the new snow-white muff with earmuffs on while trying to smile for the camera. When I was 9, I found a 4-page letter that one of my mother's boyfriends, Granville, wrote to her from Stockton, California. Evidently, he was on the run from a former wife and was trying to keep his location a secret. He also struggled with an alcohol problem himself and promised Mama, "I never am going to drink any more whiskey again, and not many cocktails, for I know as well as you that no good will ever come from it, and it will really ruin you." While Mama never accepted his marriage proposal in the letter, and I never got any perks from Granville, he sounded like a nice guy when he signed his letter, "I beg to remain yours very truly." When I was 10, Mama decided to move into a larger apartment just around the corner. It was okay overall, but had a problem with both roaches and mice. My sister Judy and I were terrified. Then thankfully, Mama started dating a guy who worked for a pesticide company. I remember his coming in and spraying the kitchen and putting out some type of pellets that he said would take care of the mice. Mama said goodbye to him once we were rodent free. That summer, Mama decided she wanted to quit her job as a waitress and take us to the coast for the summer, but she couldn't quite figure out how to make it work. That is, until she met Mr. Levy. He was a nice Jewish man, but rather old for her. He loaned her $100 for the trip, nevertheless. I remember his trying to kiss her while going out the apartment door and her pushing him away. We had a great summer. Mama met Ronnie while she was working at the Holiday Inn, and he was laying carpets. They quickly became a couple. I remember eating red beans and rice, red beans and rice, red beans and rice for weeks that summer, and Ronnie was always there every day to eat with us, since his check from Holiday Inn had not come in yet. When the $90 check arrived, we all went to the grocery store. I remember yearning for some green grapes in the produce section and asking in an amazingly quiet voice, "Do you think I could buy some grapes?" I was told by Ronnie, "Honey, you can have anything in this store you want." I thought my food insecurity issues were finally over. Another one of my wishes during childhood was to take dancing lessons. I would even lie to my friends at Ella Darling Elementary School and say that I took lessons. Once I even humiliated myself by borrowing a children's size 12 tap shoes my friend Marilyn had outgrown, and I tried to do a tap dance in the talent show. I wore an adult size 2 at the time. Mama was still with Ronnie when we returned from the coast that year, and she told me he was going to pay, finally, for me to take dancing lessons. I could see myself in the future dancing on my toes the way some of the girls in the talent show did. Unfortunately, the dance lessons ended when Ronnie's wife beckoned him to come home. When I was 11, I had my first ever birthday party at the Indian Mounds in Greenville, Mississippi. It was paid for by Mama's new boyfriend, Joe, who was in the Air Force at Keesler. He was some dozen or so years younger, but he seemed to love my sister and me just as much as he loved Mama. Hot dogs and Cokes have never tasted so good since that party. In addition to the perks given to me by my mother's boyfriends, I also learned some additional lessons and tolerance for others. For example, in our nearly all-white town, as I mentioned earlier, Hank was a Cherokee, Mr. Levy was Jewish, and Doyle, a whole nother story entirely, was a paraplegic. While life always consists of multiple coming-of-age moments for us, one of the most important was learning to sacrifice these newly found perks. You see, Mama's latest boyfriend, Nelson, came to me when I was 16 and said he and Mama would be getting married in a few months. She had known him since high school, and they seemed to have the best of all reasons to marry. They were true friends. As for me, I soon learned that I did not need Mama's boyfriends and the perks anymore. I learned I could dance on my toes myself. There was one surprise, however, left. In 2004, when I was about to turn 60 years old, my stepfather Nelson died and left me with a surprise, $100,000 in his will.
Lisa Brandom is a retired professor of English. She has written two memoirs, The Skagway Connection and Four Women, One Century. She just published a novel, Searching for Hen, available as a Kindle edition. Next, Marianne Kovach's gift is unexpected in Are You My Mother?
Mama, I scream as I sit up in bed. My heart pounding. I force my eyes open, blink. I wipe away the sleepy ooze from my tawny lashes and realize it has been 7 months exactly since the cancer defeated her. I haven't been by your house, Mama, since it sold. I don't know if I'll ever go back. I think you'd like the lady who bought it, though. I hope she'll take care of it. The nightstand clock reads 9:30. Honey, my mixed with who knows what chihuahua, had performed her Cirque du Soleil acrobatics against the side of my bed to rouse me and is now exhibiting her ritualistic boot scooting, producing a snail-like trail of tiny beige hairs to linger until the next round of vacuuming. Meanwhile, Willie, my tender-hearted, scruffy-whiskered, black-and-white half-breed terrier, who moves a tad on the cranky side, prior to his ceremonial neck-extending stretch, needs to relieve himself. Groggy from sleep, I drag my body from bed and stagger into the hall. Aware that the insanely torrid temperatures are rising, I shudder at the thought of opening the door. Guys, I'm hurrying. Bless your heart. Stepping onto the wooden deck, Little Rock summertime slaps me in the face. It may hit 108 degrees today, kids. The air is like wet, dirty socks. Local weathermen predict our fair city will experience an unusually long heat wave. Record-breaking, stifling high temperatures and oppressive humidity are in store. I feel perspiration gathering in every crook, crack, and cranny of my body. It is difficult to breathe. I think to myself, your frail, diseased lungs wouldn't tolerate this miserable heat, Mama. I miss you, but I'm glad you're not here. Gangs of blue jays squawk and crows caw, waiting for their special breakfast, torn up pieces of white bread. The songbirds flit about the hanging bird feeders as they nab safflower and sunflower seeds. Ruby-throated hummingbirds dart through the thick and heavy morning air, punch drunk on sugar water. A rogue member of the band of cottontail rabbits lazily lounges under the weathered bench. Sprawled on her side, white downy belly exposed, posing for the centerfold in Play Bunny. A chipmunk darts past me, vaulting himself not onto the rim of the nearest concrete birdbath, but up onto the edge of the Arlington, the outlying and secluded copper-rinsing district where he sips the tepid water. Gray squirrels bark at each other as they scurry up and down the hickories and pines, and my lone, distinguished red squirrel bolts out from beneath the cedar, fluffy, rust-colored tail jerking. I sigh. Peace surrounds me. However, in the blink of an eye, the moment vanishes. I clumsily reach for my favorite chair's armrest and sink down into the weaved nylon. Unable to stop the tears streaming down my puffy cheeks, I squeeze my eyes shut. Mama, why can't I be happy? I raise my throbbing head and look upward, yearning for an angel to peer from above, then whisper aloud, "This pain, will I never be allowed to heal?" Then I hear her. No, it isn't my mother's voice. I hear a bird, the bird. She's up in the trees. I search for her distinct crisp markings, crimson hood, soft snowy breast, and striking plumage contrasts, strokes of wet liquid paper on an opulent coating of ebony, visible on her tuxedo accoutrement of wings and tail feathers. While the waxy oak leaves and the blinding angle of the sun's rays concealed her whereabouts, she continued making the sound, her sound, the trill of a single, brand new playing card, firmly close-pinned to a spinning bicycle spoke. I expected her to swoop down from a branch, perch on the farthest feeder in the backyard, and retrieve her favorite seed and lard-filled suet. Yet today, she shielded herself from my view and talked. What I heard was what I needed to. "Marianne, don't be sad. We may no longer be with you, but you are not alone. You, our only child, are part of us, and we are part of you. That cannot change. Daddy and I live on in your memories. Every morning when you wake up, every night before you fall asleep, you'll feel us. When the wind brushes your cheeks, it is our hands that caress your skin. You will sense our presence whenever you're uneasy or scared. Even your childlike giggling will remind you of the laughter, the love we shared as a family, and this will forever provide you strength. When your time comes, the three of us will be together. But live your life first." It was a spellbinding moment, hearing my mother's words in the woodpecker's trilling. Suddenly, the solution became undeniably clear. In order to move on with life, it would be up to me to get through this last stage of grief and restore my spirit. "I want to live," I shouted. Willie and Honey stopped their sniffing and stood at a standstill in the yard, checking to make sure I was all right. "I'm fine, you two. Everything's okay, I promise." Then my mind took off like an Indy Roadster. "Mama, ever since Daddy's death, you told me that you dreaded this day. I dreaded it too. The day that I would be all alone. Well, this day is here, and it's worse than I ever thought it could be. After Daddy died, our lives were never the same. For years, you know this to be true, we both stopped living. When you passed away, I became completely lost. I've been lost ever since. You're gone, Mama. You're gone. How do I start to live?" On cue, the red-headed woodpecker glided in for landing, seized several hunks of soot, and then took off again. As I watched this majestic bird ascend into the cloudless blue, I smiled because I knew, I can't explain how, through this regal creature, Mama had just given me her blessing to be happy. Thank you, Mama.
Marianne Kovach and her husband Gabor enjoy being at home, cooking, and appreciating their outdoor sanctuary. Their only kids have four legs. She's currently working on a chronicled compilation of personal short stories. In our final story of the night, Martha Peters takes us to a bygone era and a gift that helped someone in Maury.
One spring morning in 1944, while war raged in many parts of the world, my mother and five other Warren, Arkansas matrons attempted a battle of their own. None had ever set a pair of spectator pumps in a courtroom before. But that day, they all put on their straw hats and white gloves, tucked their folding fans and linen handkerchiefs into their pocketbooks, and marched purposefully up the Bradley County Courthouse steps to save a black man. Maury was on trial for murder. Maury Lewis was the six ladies' longtime faithful yard man. Maury wouldn't hurt a fly, Mama said, and besides, what would we do without him? A dependable, hardworking, cheerful, weekly fixture in each of the ladies' lives, Maury had always been the most gentle of souls. Until the night he embedded an axe in a man's head. When I was old enough to ask, Mama had explained that Maury had first come to the ladies during the dark days of the Depression. He appeared knocking at back doors, shivering, scared, starving. His desperate family had abandoned him, had moved on, looking for better opportunities for survival elsewhere. Probably, Mama said, he was between 12 and 15. I know little of how Maury was incorporated into these ladies' lives, but soon he had regular employment with six women who taught him what he needed to know to work efficiently inside and outside their homes. At that time in the South, there were definite limitations as to what white women could or would do to assist a black man, no matter what age or circumstance. What these women did for Maury was admirable, everyone thought then. Today, we might tend to look at what they did not do, but Maury had been conditioned by circumstances to have few expectations of life, and given his previous deprivations, Maury thrived under the smallest of attentions. At that time in the South, it was also an unspoken truth that black men were seen but rarely heard as they went about their duties in white people's lives. Maury became in time a clown character because of the ways in which he violated the standard to achieve what was evidently the strongest of his personal needs, that of recognition. A block away from our house, Maury would begin a slight cough, frequently interrupted with throat clearing. By the time he was passing the Moody house, he was much louder, and by the time he was coming down our driveway, he was in a full coughing spasm. Thus alerted, Mama would have his breakfast plate on the kitchen table and be standing with the screen door open as he came up the steps with a big smile on his face. When he was working in the yard, any passersby would prompt the same coughing performance. Maury would begin to rake more slowly, while his eyes locked on a neighbor crossing a street or a kid riding by on a bicycle. His coughing and throat clearing would get louder and louder until eye contact was established and a verbal greeting was issued by whomever he was trying to engage. Traditional protocol that a white person must speak first was always observed. Then Maury was free to respond. He would stop sweeping, lean upon his broom or rake, say something about the weather, wave his handkerchief, wipe his face, scratch his head, shift his broom. his enthusiastic animation and very visible pleasure at the smallest attention given him endeared him to most. More often, he was engaged with good and kind humor, and he returned to his work, smiling, reaffirmed once more. Upon request, Murray would often entertain me by playing my piano. Mysteriously, he possessed untaught musical ability and would play well-known hymns in a rollicking, ragtime stride piano style. He gained wide recognition throughout the black community by playing the piano for his Holy Roly Church during their regular meeting times and during their frequent summer outdoor revivals, which attracted crowds of both races. Most from Maurice's community went for spiritual reasons. Most from the white community went for entertainment. Mama would give Marie a big breakfast, then a big dinner at noon. She would stand and wait on Marie while he ate, just as if she were the help. She got enjoyment from his evident appreciation of her food. She would tell me that Marie always told her she was the best cook of all his ladies. I replied once, "Mama, I bet he tells that to every one of you." She looked at me solemnly. "Oh, no, honey, he's not that smart." I was not as sure as she was. Breakfast got cold at Mama's the first Saturday morning Maury was ever late. He said later that he didn't know the man who had come to call on him in the middle of the night, uninvited and reluctant to leave. Maury needed his sleep. It was already late. He had been to church all evening long, had walked home, and in the morning he would have to walk across town again to Mama's house. He wanted to go to bed, but first he had to convince his unwelcome guest to leave. "Something must be wrong. Maurice's never late," she said. Mama covered his plate with a tea towel and put it in the barely warm oven. Maurice had not intended to be late. But when he woke that day, he realized his house needed a little tidying up before he left. A bit of wet mopping here and there, in the kitchen, in the bedroom, across his front porch, and down the steps. Then there was the man still in his ditch to consider. Mr. Whitbrook's back property lay across the alley from Maury's little house. Unimproved streets, such as the alley, often had a ditch on each side to take care of water drainage. As Maury stood in the early light that Saturday morning, he did not recall Mr. Whit ever having a man in his ditch. Generously, he moved the cold guest across the road. Mama said Marie was positively pale when he arrived at our house sometime later. She watched him as he dawdled with his breakfast. Finally, he said, "Miss Willie Bess, I'm scared." "Why are you scared, Marie?" "I seen a man in Mr. Witt's ditch this morning, and I think he was dead." "Oh, Marie, he was probably just drunk, don't you think?" "No, he had lots of blood." So Mama called the police and asked them to please check on whether there was a man dead or not lolling about the Brooks' back ditch. They found him right quick and also right quick discerned a right telltale trail of evidence from that indeed dead man whose skull was split open, back across the road, down and up Marie's own ditch, across his yard, and right up to his front steps. Beyond that, everything was as neat as a pin and clean as a whistle, Mama said, including a pristine, polished axe head gleaming from the shadows beneath Maury's bed. The ladies testified to Maury's dependability, to his steadfastness, his honesty, his work ethic. But Murray had pitiful representation, Mama said, from a white, lazy lawyer who didn't care enough to put out more than a thimbleful of effort on Murray's behalf, and had a jury of white trash. Mama added that they would have found George Washington Carver guilty if he'd been up there that day. "They will kill him," she cried. "They'll put him in the fields and he won't survive. He's not used to hard labor. He can't work out in the hot sun all day." Mama wrote to Murray in prison. Occasionally, someone would write a few lines back for him. We learned Murray had 2 heat strokes before he was moved from the fields to the kitchen. Mama didn't worry as much about him after that. 2 years later, Murray was paroled, and it was to our house that he returned. Somehow, Mama had talked Daddy into letting Murray live with us until he could get on his feet again. Mama got phone calls. "Bess, are you out of your mind? Don't you and Gordon realize you could be axed to death in your bed?" Some of Mama's friends and a few of Murray's regular ladies had changed their minds about Murray's gentle nature, it seems, while he was in prison. But Mama never wavered. She and Daddy cleaned out a little room behind the garage. A cot, a chair, and a table were set up. A bare electric light hung down in the middle. Of course, Mama fed him. In time, there were enough women of courage to fill up Murray's days again. And once more, Murray became independent. Murray continued to work for Mama every Saturday for as long as she lived. Over time, he regained the affection of the community. Even the story of his killing a man softened, but no one ever visited him again in the middle of the night.
Martha Peters grew up in Warren, Arkansas, the setting for all of her memoirs. A graduate of Hendricks College and longtime resident of Charlotte, North Carolina, she and her husband now live in the North Carolina mountains. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
He rambled from town to town, hardly ever stopped to eat or put his guitar down. Made his living singing life on the road. He'd roll into town, sing his songs, then off he'd go. And he liked honky-tonk women, and he loved James Dean. Drove an old pickup truck called the Green Machine. He loved a California sunset with those chosen sands. with those toes in the sand. He believed everything was built by the master's hand. Da 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 da, la da da dee da, la da da da, la da da dee da.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.